Hi, this is Mark Steiner. Welcome. We are about to have a conversation with Mark Aronson and Marina Budos, who wrote an incredible book, something we don't think about much as you come together in the morning and drop that sugar in your tea or coffee or eat that ice cream laden with sugar or just think about how much sugar is in your life or think about just the notion of sugar and what it means for us. But the power of what sugar has done in human history is something that we don't usually see in our history books. And Mark Aronson and Marina Budos have written a book called Sugar Changed the World, a story of magic, spice, slavery, freedom, and science. And Mark and Marina, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Thank
Great
you.
Great to be here.
So this is, as we were saying before we were in the air, how you, I love the dedication both to the, in the book, to where you started, where you dedicated it to those who crossed the seas to labor in sugar, and to the great Dr. Sidney Mintz, who led the way in telling their stories, who's one of the most amazing food anthropologists on the planet Earth, I think, if not the.
You know, he truly is. And what he did in his magnificent book, Sweetness and Power, he really showed how it enslaved and millions of people and in many ways transformed life on this planet. And it was his sort of pioneering work in looking at a product not just as a, you know, either a flavoring or a dietary substance, but really as this lever, an economic lever, a social, a cultural lever that changed our world. And that book of his, you know, really opened our eyes.
And the way you two begin this is also a personal journey for the two of you between
right.
Israel and Israeli Jewish and Indian Guianan,
yes.
Ghanaian roots.
Yes.
Guyanese roots.
Yes.
Well, Marina, you want to tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my family story was somewhat known, although some of the details remained mysterious, but I certainly knew that in the mid to late 19th century, my ancestors, my great-grandparents had left northern India where to go to the Caribbean to work the sugar plantations. There had been a whole flood of Indians who had gone. And so that story was well known, and I knew that my family was touched by sugar in a sense. But what we didn't know was this other story on Mark's side, which we discovered one afternoon when we were sitting in Jerusalem. Mark, do you want to tell about that?
Yeah, you know, there was one aunt of mine who I had met late in her life, but was always mysterious. She was famously beautiful. She had lived in Palestine and Israel most of her life, but never learned Hebrew. She was born Gentile and married into my family, which had 17 consecutive generations of rabbis. And so who was she? And I asked, the family lore is that her grandfather was a serf, a Russian serf, who was so intelligent that he had invented a process for dealing with beet sugar that perhaps changed its color. We're not exactly sure of that. But it was a very successful process, so successful that he made enough money to buy his freedom and then to set up his family fortune on the basis of that work. And this happened exactly in the same time as Marina's father's ancestors were journeying from India to the Caribbean.
So yeah, and we were really struck by the fact that here you not only were just in completely different parts of the world, but these were people whose lives had been transformed by this one substance in a way they were able to propel themselves out of one particular situation, one sort of defining place, poor India, drought-ridden India at that time, and in the case of a serf. And we thought, my goodness, you know, if these two sets of people can have their lives so changed by this substance, there must be a larger story in this.
And that's what started us on our exploring, tracing both family stories and other personal stories, and also these large epic forces that Dr. Mintz had really explored.
I think few of us realize the power of sugar. A, we don't even know where it came from, most of us, I think. and B, right. the power it had and how it transformed the entire globe. I mean, that's what this story is about.
Yeah, I mean, when you think, again, when you start The Trail of Sugar, and this is almost like one of those quest novels you might read or a fantasy novel, it starts out as this small and sort of sidelight. It was a luxury item. It was a spice that was used in India in religious rituals. It was, you know, one of the natural substances that, you know, was part of the options of the medieval world, the ancient world, like ginger or garlic or something. But it was just this minor minor note. Marina, do you want to lead us a little bit from there onward?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea was that it was as Mark said, it was first used in ritual, and then it was this spice, you know, this extremely expensive spice, one should say.
Yes.
That, you know, literally cost the king's ransom to have a sack of it. So it was not, it was something that in food you would use it to accent as a flavor. It was, you know, and otherwise as well, the other thing, we call this part of the book the Age of Honey, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so sweetness had much more to do with something localized. You would get it from the honey that, you know, the beekeepers would derive. And so...
Or the local fruits. The thing about honey, if you pause to think about it for a moment, honey has the flavor of the flowers that the bees visit.
Right.
So in an economy where you get honey from down the road, you're basically tasting where you live. And that was the same with the other sweeteners generally yeah. available. You might have mashed fruit. In the Americas, they had agave cactus or maple syrup. But you really ate from the environment and tasted the environment that you lived in.
But there was... go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Marina.
Yeah, no, and so, again, with the development of sugar... comes this whole notion of a product that is now just pure sweetness that starts to be transported across boundaries, right, across seas, just for that essence of sweetness, not something that you get down the road from the local beekeeper or something like
right,
that.
And
right.
So one thing for people to think about is there wasn't a thing called dessert. There wasn't enough sweetener to create a completely separate course. What there was, and we still have it in some foods, is savories, which are part, let's say if you have a dish that has meat and fruit in it together. And it, so you had that combination of flavors where sweetening just added, you know, part of, like, think of sweet and sour pork that you might have at a Chinese restaurant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's not a dessert, but there is sweetness present as a flavor. And one of the reasons for this, and this was so interesting for us to learn, is that sugar, cane sugar, is different from any other crop. And it's different in this way. If you grow wheat, if you grow corn, if you grow rice, you can harvest it and just keep it. We were in India recently, and we saw these mounds, piles by the road, and we asked what the piles were, and the person explained that wheat farmers pile up their wheat to wait for the price to rise, and that you can do that because wheat can sit there, and it's fine. With sugarcane, you must mill it within 24 to 48 hours after you cut it. So this basically means one of two things. Either you have a small little operation, you cut a little, you mill a little, you process a little, and you have this trickle of sugar which goes out into the world. Or you create a completely new kind of agriculture. You create a farm where all you do is grow, mill, process, and prepare for the next round of growing sugar. You transform a farm, essentially, into an industrial assembly line.
And you know, actually, that was one of the brilliant insights of Dr. Mintz's book. I mean, what he recognized about a plantation is that it was a combination of sort of industrial capitalism, a factory, and feudalism, because it was this agricultural model where you had, in essence, serfs or slaves laboring. And that's what was created on the plantation.
So we, you know, traced the story of sugar through India, through the stories of Alexander, through a couple of other fascinating beats which we knew nothing about before our research. There was this school in what is now Iran.
Oh, I love that part of the book. This is amazing. I knew about the school, but you made me go back and read about it even more. Talk about that.
Yeah, there was this college called Jundishapur, which in the 500s A.D. was absolutely the world center of knowledge.
I want to go there now.
Well, you know, just as an aside, which wasn't in the book, Mark mentioned we were just in India, and it turns out, you know, that the knowledge that had been developed in Jundishapur, which included medical knowledge, of course,
right,
all of that actually carried over to India and is still being practiced in certain neighborhoods in Delhi.
Right.
It's a known form of practice.
Hmm.
You know?
We actually went to one of those neighborhoods. And, yeah, so at Jundishapur, you had, you know, we talk about, you know, and maybe this is going on the side, but, you know, sometimes people will express anti-Muslim points of view and this idea of Muslim fundamentalism as if it's this, you know, completely rigid worldview. Well, Jundishapur grew up just before the growth of Islam, and it was the place in which Nestorian Christians, Jews, people who came from Greece, the heirs of the academies of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, met with doctors from India bringing knowledge of sugar, bringing knowledge of medicine. They all shared their knowledge in Jundishapur, and this is where sugar processing began to stretch out to the world. That's in the 500s A.D. 600s A.D., Islam spreads through there. And now, Islam brought with it a language. All the practitioners of Islam learned to read Arabic. So now you have one language to share knowledge, to share the knowledge of the world. And the example I always give is while the Europeans are counting with Roman numerals,
right.
What do we call the numerals that came out of this knowledge base? We still call them Arabic numbers. Why? Because they were brought along with knowledge of the zero, which comes from India. So this spread of knowledge that came with the growth of Islam brought with it knowledge of sugar. And this now started to spread so the Europeans got a little taste, spread so the Chinese, who had some beginning knowledge of sugar, would import people from Egypt to process their sugar.
Because the Egyptians were the ones who created that first incredible white sugar.
And they went through these endless repetitive processes of actually using milk in the processing of sugar to get this white color. Marco Polo actually commented on this, on the presence of the Egyptian sugar masters in China. And then the other interesting beat in this early phase is, so how are the poor Europeans, the sort of benighted, trapped, insular, Roman numeral counting Europeans, going to get knowledge of sugar? Well, partially through the Crusades. You tramp through the Middle East, you find sugar. But the other way was this very smart count in France said, all right, you know what, guys? We got to have some trading places. We have to have trading places where you can trust the weights and measures. You're going to get a fair deal. Come to these six towns that I'll set up for you, and we'll have, you know, the international trade fair. And so Italian merchants would go off to the Muslim lands, and they would buy exotic things like oranges or lemons or pepper or sugar and bring it to what were called the Champagne Fairs, where the Europeans could begin to sample and taste and buy it. And so this is sort of the world of sugar up until about 1300. But now the Muslims who have become really gotten to know sugar make the both great and terrible invention. So do you want to say what the invention is, Marina?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
They invent the sugar plantation. They are the management experts who figure out how you can devote one farm to doing nothing but growing one crop. And they begin to experiment with this throughout the Mediterranean and to the islands off just off the coast of Africa. And they use slave labor. Slaves were basically whoever they could capture in war. Apparently a significant percentage of the slave labor were Russians, just captured off of boats or traded for. And then we come now to the page that Marina and I argue about.
Yeah, we have this running argument in the family.
What is that?
Well, which is we both love this moment in the story where we get to this whole idea of this plant that is now being brought over from these islands.
Do you have the passage there, Marina?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay, I will read the passage, and then Marina will explain the argument. So I'll just read. In the 1400s, Spain and Portugal were competing to explore down the coast of Africa and find a sea route to Asia. That way they could have the prized Asian spices they wanted without having to pay high prices to Venetian and Muslim middlemen. Spanish and Portuguese sailors searching for that sea route conquered the Canary Islands and the Azores. Soon they were building Muslim-style sugar plantations on the islands, some of them staffed by slaves purchased from nearby Africa. One sailor came to know these islands particularly well because he traded in white gold, sugar. And then, as he set off on his second voyage across the sea to what he thought was Asia, he carried sugar cane plants from Gomorrah, one of the Canary Islands, with him on his ship. His name
was Christopher Columbus.
So this is the line that we argue. I claim that it was my idea to structure the end of the chapter that way. Mark claims it was his, and we still have not come to any.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since I am not getting in the middle of that one.
But of course, you know, this really does usher in an utterly different era.
It does, and one of the things that really strikes me is that here we have this product sugar. And this substance sugar, the Europeans who live on bread and mead, all of a sudden has this stuff and they become addicted immediately. Everybody wants sugar, but this is where it really does get interesting. I think this is part of your analysis that I think that is kind of new in the sense that people don't really think about how the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Slavery,
right.
And the development of the modern world and the cross-fertilization of cultures throughout the globe are really based around the substance you wrote about sugar. That's the piece that is so fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, before you know it, obviously, in the 17th, 18th, the 18th century, these plantations are just, you know, bringing up everywhere. Massive amounts of sugar are being created with slave labor, and the question is, for whom? Who is drinking?
Wait, but you've jumped one. You're right, Marina, but let's can we do one beat before that?
All right.
Okay, so the one beat before it is, all right, we've said sugar needs to be processed quickly. What does sugar need? It needs fertile soil. It needs water. It needs a lot of wood because you have to boil the sugar. It needs to be near water so you can transport it.
Right.
All of those things exist in various places in the world. There's one more thing sugar needs, and that's cheap labor. That sentence is the explanation of the Atlantic slave trade. And to get to your point, Mark, when we teach in our schools about the Atlantic slave trade, we talk about cotton.
Right.
Tobacco.
Right.
That's fine.
Right.
That's true. that happens in America, no denying it. Cotton and tobacco were the tiniest fraction of the story of the Atlantic slave trade. The Atlantic slave trade, and I've said this too many times, but I just have to keep repeating it, of the 12 million or so Africans who were shipped across the Atlantic, 96% went to the Sugar Land. And, you know, that is the astonishing truth. But when we say sugar changed the world, you are now talking about 10 million or so Africans sold, shipped, and condemned into life in what we call sugar hell. And this is because sugar was so popular, and that gets back, Marina.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the joke, you know, the line that's given is that sugar was the oil of the 18th century. It was really driving the motor of the economy, of the global economy. And, you know, it again gets back to this question, you know, why this rise in demand? You know, why these barrels full of sugar, they called them hogsheads, you know, why were they being shipped off in this way? And as you hinted at, you know, the people who were consuming this sugar were the factory workers. In other words, they had to power through their day in some way. They were now working 12, 14-hour shifts. These were people who in another era might have lived on farms, might have taken a break and eaten the food that was sort of in the land just around them in the localized area. But now they are part of an industrial economy where they're working in factories. And let's say they get their 15-minute shift. What do? They sweeten their tea or their coffee so they can get their caffeine, their jolt of caffeine. They sweeten it with sugar, and they can get through the day, you know, to the next shift. And that becomes, you know, what we now know of as our coffee break. Or, you know, they start to manufacture, you know, they might sprinkle some sugar on a hunk of bread, and then there's the whole idea of having cookies, which became a new invention during this period. So many of the food items that we think of, many of the food habits we've developed, all emerged at this time during the Industrial Revolution. So what you have is this connection between the labor of slaves feeding the labor of, you know, the industrial workers in Europe and in England.
And actually, when we looked into this, some of the most recent studies have shown it's even more than that. What were the factories that, you know, when we think of the Industrial Revolution, where does it start? Okay, English cloth manufacturers. What cloth are they producing? Rough cloth
for slaves
to clothe the slaves. So it's this complete cycle where you know, literally human life, it's almost like a storm system. You know, it's like this tornado that's spinning around, transforming lives around the planet.
Mark Aronson, Marina Budos, the book is Sugar Changed the World, a story of magic, spice, slavery, freedom, and science. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. On our way to break, we're hearing Goodbye Blue Sky by Pink Floyd, from their album and film, The Wall. The film version was released on this day in 1982.
Did you see the frightened ones? Did you hear the falling bombs? Did you ever wonder why we had to run for shelter when the promise of a brave new world unfurled beneath the clear blue sky?
If I could be anything in the world that flew, I would be a bat and come swooping after you. And if the last time you were here, things were a bit askew, Well, you know what happens after dark. When rattlesnakes lose their skins and their hearts, and all the missionaries lose their bark. Oh, all the trees are calling after you, and all the venom snipers after you. Are all the mountains bolder after you?
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Andy's Chest by Lou Reed. It's about Andy Warhol, who was born on this day in 1928. Today on the program, we'll bring you some of our favorite segments from the past two decades of The Mark Steiner Show. What you're about to hear is a pre-record, so we can't accept any calls. Please send us any feedback to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Mark Aronson, Marina Budos, the book is Sugar Changed the World, a story of magic, spice, slavery, freedom, and science. So one of the things, there's some quotes in here that I think that just to kind of get our, just to get our listeners to hear, but to get a sense of this. One of them that really hit me was, as we get to this age, we talk about slavery, and you have these incredible descriptions of the battle against slavery that took place immediately. But you have this great line I think we should explore just for a minute. Without sugar, no Brazil. Without slaves, no sugar. Without Angola, no slaves.
Right.
And the idea of this, how the whole notion of Western slavery was created around sugar, which really does, I think, is important because we do have the cotton myth, as you said earlier, of why we have slavery. I mean, cotton was like the afterthought.
Mm-hmm. Cotton was, look, slavery has existed since the first human, you know, got a club and
right.
managed to knock
but
down.
But this was a different slavery.
The next human. But this scale of slavery.
This is industrial slavery.
Right. And
this notion of shipping, you know, massive amounts. An entire industry that grew up around slave ships and moving, you know, the scale of people across the seas for these very particular products, this was unseen of, you know, before.
To use a horrible word, but, you know, I just read a book about Mao and the Great Famine. And one of the tragedies of the 20th century is we became much more efficient. We became much more efficient at destroying people. And in a certain way, that sort of begins with Atlantic slavery. We were just much more efficient at enslaving and shipping people than we ever had been before. We were more efficient at using their labor. And so back to what Marina was saying, the effect of this is we took this luxury good and made it so cheap that it wasn't just an extra, it was an absolute necessity.
Right, and we've now moved to a period where it becomes a staple. It became a vital staple in the diet, particularly of Europeans.
And this happens absolutely through the labor of the Africans. And so one thing to get to your point, Mark, is it's important for us to recognize that too often we teach Atlantic slavery as this sort of horrible, sad thing, and then we teach the Industrial Revolution as this sort of triumph of machinery and science. Have to remember that, no,
it's
the Africans that make this possible.
And we never connected. This is the thing
you've done.
No, we never connected.
Right.
We don't connect that.
The rise
of capitalism, the Industrial Revolution, and slavery,
right.
and how they're interwoven so deeply.
That's right. That interconnection is so profound. And again, in trying to grasp this epic story, this epic interconnected story, really it's for people to remember that there's the slave, you know, in Antigua, let's say, and, you know, there's the factory worker in Manchester, and they are in some way connected by this substance.
Sure.
Right. And that actually gets to... Oh, I'm sorry, Mark.
Go ahead. It gets us to what? Go ahead.
No, well, where I was leading to is one of... And this actually leads to me, what is the most profound question that this whole story raises. So here we take this factory worker in Manchester. He is employed, or she is employed, working in this machine to produce cloth for the slave trade. He's eating the products of the slave trade. His entire livelihood, in some way, is now bound up in sugar slavery. He can't vote because in England only 3% of the population have any influence on government. And that Manchester factory worker or his wife will now lead the campaign against slavery.
And
you have to add, there is something so profound in that. Because it's so easy to be cynical. Oh, you know, people, you know, they just care about what's in front of them. They just want their another day, another job, another cookie, you know, whatever. But those people whose lives were determined by this, their economic life, you know, their daily little spot of pleasure, led the campaign that for the first time in human history successfully abolished.
Well, in the time we have left, that's why I'm going to kind of hone in on this a little bit here.
Sorry.
It's that when you write in this book about the connections between, you have this in wonderful sections about, I mean, you really describe in your book the pain of slavery. When you write about Thomas Thistlewood and as the overseer and how people were worked to death on these sugar plantations and why and who they picked, and then you talk about the revolts, like the maroon revolts that took place throughout the area, but then how that's connected to, you're connecting that to the rise of the belief in freedom and democracy, of equality of all men,
right,
came out of sugar, came out of France, came before Thomas Jefferson, and bubbled this thing up that led to the thing you're talking about in Britain, which is this incredible sojourn and battle to end the slave trade. I mean, and all wrapped up. That's part of the story, that interconnectedness of that story is what's so phenomenal to me about all this.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that sugar is this sort of thread that's running through everything that you've cited. And I do think it's absolutely fascinating that the abolition movement succeeded because they pointed to this substance that had become so central to people's lives. How could people live without their sugar? You know, it was on their table every morning, right, with their tea, with their coffee. And yet that it was precisely its ubiquity. The sense that it was there every day in your face made them able to point out this injustice. And that was really the brilliance of the abolitionists, that they were saying, do not drink this blood-sweetened beverage. You know, do not buy this product that has been made, you know, in this savage way. And that's quite profound.
Because it does, we're accustomed now to going into a store and seeing some fair trade label, and maybe we'll pay attention to it and maybe we won't, or maybe we'll see some label on a rug that assures us that no child labor was involved. And, you know, it's so ubiquitous that we're in a way dulled to it. But the people who really invented that idea, that a product links you to the person who produced it.
And a system, and an unjust system.
Yes,
that
created
work.
It.
Yeah.
And I think that really was profound. And it's back to what you say about interconnectedness. You're interconnected in one way in that the factory worker needs the slave-produced sugar. You're connected in another way that the factory worker can take a stand against slavery. And that actually leads to the twist that neither of us knew when we began the book, and that connects to actually Marina's background.
Yeah, I mean, again, thinking about when you were talking about these ideas of individual freedom and how sugar was entangled with it, you know, another profound idea was the notion of nonviolence as a way of fighting injustice. And again, I had always known the story of Gandhi, that he sort of first learned his techniques and developed politically in South Africa as a young barrister. But it wasn't until we did this book that I read the story of him working in his office, and one day this man coming into his office with broken teeth, broken ribs, and so forth. And he said what happened. He had been abused by a plantation owner. And Gandhi asked himself, what is this system that would so treat a man like a slave? And, you know, this then led to his involvement in the campaign for the rights of Indians in South Africa who had been brought there to largely work in the sugar plantations, so some other industries as well. And this began to be the development of satyagraha, you know, the whole idea of truth force, soul force, or, as we know it, nonviolence.
So these connections that you've made, I think, are very profound in that because you've done it in kind of a way that most people don't look at history, I think, in terms of being able to connect these dots that make us understand kind of the political economy of sugar and its profound effect on. I mean, what I got out of this was the profound effect that sugar in the 21st century, where we are now, are the root of that, as where we are now today in terms of the power of the notion of democracy and freedom, the power of, as you write about, and you write about the music, the power of the African diasporic culture, what it's done to the planet Earth,
right,
and the interaction of those things and the battles of regular workers in England to fight for black men and women who are enslaved, it's mind-boggling when you think about how those things go together. We never connect them.
And you know, the last thing I would say here, again, we've mentioned being in India. And, you know, we talk about now about globalization and we have to be aware of, well, that's all true. But if we lift our head up from any subject that we teach or that we think about, any moment in American history, if you just look a little beyond the familiar, you find that it was really part of world history. So, as we've said, yeah, sure, we should know about cotton and tobacco. But once you shift to sugar, and that is profoundly the story of Louisiana, you now see American history as part of this world tapestry, this world fabric. And so much more interesting, and I think, you know, Marina and I have ideas for future books, and we want to keep re-emphasizing this point. It's not like the world was all separate, and then we woke up on January 1st, 2000, and suddenly decided to be connected.
Right, exactly.
And I think how much more interesting when we trace these links, when we see these bonds that really have always been there. I want to say very briefly, we do have a website called sugarchangetheworld.com.
Good music.
Which has music related to that came out of the sugar lands, because certainly one way to celebrate that African diasporic culture, as well as the Indian diasporic culture and the Japanese and Chinese and Philippine diasporic culture, all involved with sugar, is by enjoying and celebrating and honoring and appreciating and dancing to the music and dance that came out of those lands.
This is something that you wrote in the middle of the book on the age of sugar. And I'd like to read it just for our listeners to get put their hands around it. By the 1800s, it was clear that the age of sugar, that combination of enslavement, factories, and global trade, was replacing the age of honey, when people ate local foods, lived on the land of their ancestors, and valued tradition over change. Sugar was the product of the slave and the addiction of the poor factory worker, the meeting place of barbarism of overseers such as Thomas Thistlewood and the rigid new economy. And yet, for that very reason, sugar also became the linchpin of the struggle for freedom. When we talk about Atlantic slavery, we must describe sugar hell, and yet that is only part of the story. Africans were at the heart of this great change in the economy, indeed in the lives of people throughout the world. Africans were the true global citizens, adjusting to a new land, a new religion, even to other Africans they would never have met in their homelands. Their labor made the age of sugar, the industrial age, possible. We should not see the enslaved people simply as victims, but rather as actors, as the heralds of the interconnected world in which we all live today. And indeed, it was when the enslaved Africans began to speak, in words and in actions, when Europeans began to see them as human, that the age of sugar also became the age of freedom. That, to me, is one of the most profound statements I've read in a book a long time about that part of our history.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We did write that, and I've been reading books since then. And what people emphasize, when we think of slavery, it's easy to think of Africans as you know, sort of downtrodden, you know, sort of brutalized. All of that is true. But if you think of the modern world where, you know, we think of immigration, we think of moving from one country to another and adjusting to a new culture, we think of, you know, the way religions change, the way people adopt new identities. If we think of America, the land of reinvention, where the land of the second chance, well, the people who had to do that were the Africans. The Africans had to come here. They had no common language. They had no common religion. They had no common culture. They had to build all of that under the most brutal conditions while continuing to labor, while also passing on something to their descendants and creating newness for the world from which we've all benefited.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that as this pressure to end slavery,
right,
or with this pressure to see them as human beings and not as property, it began to finally bring out into the open these notions of liberty. What do we mean by liberty? What
right.
do we mean by to be a citizen? What do we mean by individual rights? When you have these previously thought to be, you know, subhuman or property, chattel, in a sense,
right,
where that starts to press against the structures that be. So, you know, I think Mark's right that in a way, as we sort of shift the kaleidoscope a little bit and put it in perspective, to think of them as actors who really forced this tremendous change in our now most fervently held beliefs.
And if you think about it, this is true in one very specific way, which again relates to our current world, which is it is because the Haitians achieved their freedom,
right,
that Napoleon sells the Louisiana Territory to America. It is, so it profoundly, the United States, the continental United States, is Haiti's gift because they, the Haitians, defeated the two most powerful armies in the world, the British and the French, and achieved their independence. Napoleon had to give up on his plan for Saint-Dominique to be his great moneymaker, and he no longer needed the center of continental United States. So right there, if we, instead of viewing Haiti as this basket case, cholera-stricken, you know, earthquake-prone disaster area that elicits sympathy, okay, fine, have sympathy, but also have honor. They accomplished something of which we are the direct beneficiary.
Right. And I think that's, I mean, this is part, again, of our history, especially now. It's so fascinating to me that if you look at the book that you wrote, that you can tie it to the world we're in now, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, whether it's globalization or Haiti or the power of democracy. I mean, you can almost, I mean, it might, I don't think this is a stretch I'm about to say. You can tell me you think it is. But even if we look at the power of a love of freedom that is fueling Tunisia, Yemen,
right,
Egypt today,
right,
all of that really to me is traced to the roots. I mean, you don't think about the international slave trade, industrialization, and sugar as being the root of our democratic fervor on the planet Earth.
But you put it very well. It mobilized, because again, if you think about it, in England, when they abolished slavery, again, 3% of the population could vote. It, certainly, women couldn't vote. Generally, poor people couldn't vote.
Right.
And yet it was women who would circulate petitions, who would march, who would, would wear, carry handbags showing the figure of a kneeling slave. You know, it was workers, as you said, in the factories who made their voices heard, even though they had no way of being, they had no direct influence on Parliament and certainly not on the House of Lords. But they made their voices felt, much as in Tunisia and in these other parts of the world now, people are saying, okay, maybe you can control us, but we have a voice. We have something we need to say. We need to be heard.
So you'd like to see this book go into schools so students in high schools can wrestle with this stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's where this book should be.
I mean, if only you know, the 96% figure alone is a thought-provoking number to begin with, especially given how this topic is usually taught, you know. And that alone would suddenly, you know, walls would come tumbling down, because you really have to move beyond the story of slavery within a national context.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yeah, and we've put a teacher's guide on the website for that. And I just want to conclude by saying, you know, we've gotten a lot of great comments and responses, but every so often someone will say, you know, aren't your claims exaggerated? How can you say, you know, that, you know, sugar has changed the world? And I have to say, honestly, the strange thing is when you look at the real studies, the academic studies, if anything, we're understating it. I mean, we're making big claims because it's true. you know, not because of some bombastic impulse.
No, it's true. This has been great.
Well, thank you for having us and letting us have our say.
It's been wonderful. It's good to meet you both. Mark Aronson, Marina Budos. The book is Sugar Changed the World, a story of magic, spice, slavery, freedom, and science. You can link to their website and this book at steinershow.org at our website, and continue the discussion, because I think it's an important one to have. Thank you so much for the work that you both did.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Break, we're hearing Waltz No. 2 by Elliott Smith. He was born on this day in 1969.